Welcome, everyone, to another broadcast of Authors First on the Artists First Radio Network. This is something we have been doing now for, 22 years, 23 years? I think we started our 23rd anniversary in March of 2018. And I know you all, so why aren't you guys any good at it? Well, we try, folks. We do bring you the best new music you've never heard and the best new books you need to read. This could be one of them. What a timely book we have coming up for the next hour, especially in these days that we live in. Let me give our guest a proper introduction. Our guest is, clear my throat there. Our guest tonight has over 30 years of experience as a healthcare professional and is a recognized authority in the areas of quality, risk management, and patient safety. She earned a Bachelor's of Science in Nursing from the University of Florida, and her Master's of Science in Leadership from Nova Southeastern University. She's a registered nurse holding state and national certifications in case, quality, and risk management, and she's been a speaker at various local and national conferences. Her current focus is on ensuring patient safety, care, and coordination, and bringing dignity to the end of life care. There are more letters after our guest's name than there are letters in the alphabet. Welcome, Judith Sands.
Thank you. I'm excited to be with you tonight.
Welcome, Judith. Again, congratulations on your, boy, you must be an education enthusiast to have gone through all of those different, all that training and get all those, what do we call them, degrees, certificates?
And credentials.
Credentials, thank you.
It's a way of establishing professional status and then becoming recognized in areas of expertise.
Well, I think in the game of status, you win. Let's go through these. After Judith's name is, first of all, RN, registered nurse, then MSL, Master of Science Leadership, BSN, Bachelor of Science Nursing, CPHRM, Certified Professional Healthcare Risk Management, CPHQ, Certified Professional Healthcare Quality, CCM, Certified Care Manager, LHRM, Licensed Healthcare Risk Manager, and ARM, Associate Risk Manager. Wow. That's a mouthful. I guarantee you that you have more letters after your name than any other guest we've ever had on this station in 23 years. Congratulations.
Thank you. That background prepared me for this journey of home hospice navigation for my mom.
Judith, on the cover of the book, is that you and your mother?
Yes, it is. We're very close, and I think that picture depicts the very positive relationship that we had.
Now, congratulations. Is this your first book?
It is my first book, and this was my desire to make the journey easier for other families.
This is a very timely topic. I guess hospice has always been around, but as our society ages, and the baby boomers, of which I'm part of, we're all getting older now. Many are retiring. We're going to need more home hospice than ever. Although, I'm in my mind, I'm stereotyping home hospice to mean elderly people, but that's not necessarily the case, is it?
No, it's not. Many of the individuals who take advantage of the hospice benefit package are those at end stage of a variety of diseases or conditions. Could be end stage kidney, end stage cardiac, dementia with a variety of other factors. And unfortunately, we have a large population of very frail elderly. And as one condition becomes exacerbated or exaggerated, the other body systems can't compensate. And many folks are now at the point where they say, I want to have quality of life in my last days and don't necessarily want to focus it on dying. How am I going to die? But how am I going to live during this last phase of my life?
Dying is a delicate topic that most of us don't want to think about. And consequently, what your book tries to encourage people to do is plan ahead. But, you know, topics that, you know, we're uncomfortable with, I'm one of those. I'm weak-minded. I just don't want to think about it.
There's a lot we don't want to think about. Unfortunately, if we do not plan ahead and make our wishes known, others aren't going to know how we want to live out those last days. What's important to us? Where do we want that to take place? And the difference with home hospice versus having hospice in a hospice facility or in a nursing home is that in the home setting, the caregiver, often it's the families that take on this burden, or if the family members are out of the area, then they are hiring individuals to take on that caregiving responsibility. And dying has been taken away from the home. 100 years ago, the loved one died in their own bed, surrounded by family, clergy, friends. But now that often dying is taking place behind closed doors. And it's uncomfortable because we haven't seen it. Many folks have not seen a loved one die. And TV doesn't really depict it well.
You know, recently the Barbara Bush, First Lady Barbara Bush, passed away, and the days leading up to it, the media sort of painted the exact same picture that you were just describing that was traditional in the older days. I don't know, I sort of thought that was wonderful. I had that visual in my mind that there she is, surrounded by two presidents, a former governor, and on. What a wonderful, wonderful way to die. And you're dying at home, not in some hospital or other facility hooked up to machines and, you know, the beeps and the smells of being there. And you're surrounded in your own environment. I mean, wouldn't anybody want to stay home rather than go to a facility? To me, it's a no-brainer.
And we have to give Barbara Bush credit. She called it comfort care, which truly is what hospice is. Unfortunately, most people did not realize that comfort care is the hospice service. And I think that's the unfortunate piece, that not too many in the media said comfort care is equal to hospice.
How long did it take you to write this book?
About a 2-year time frame. My mom was involved with it in the early days. And part of what was the emphasis for the book, or the little nudge in the backside, was Mom would say, well, what do people do without someone like you? Referring to they don't know how to navigate the medical system, and they don't have your experience. I have sat over the years with many families talking to them about going for the hospice option, having them sort out their end-of-life wishes. I was very fortunate. Mom was very articulate and had planned ahead. Her idea and philosophy was that I should not be burdened. I'm an only child, and I often spoke to me, myself, and I, and it was amazing. We were always in congruence and agreed on the plan. But I know that is not the same for many other families.
Well, and the fact that your mom could communicate effectively, someone like, for instance, with Alzheimer's, of course they can talk, but are they really expressing, understanding the situation? Probably not. And so someone has to make those choices for them.
My friend Molly had a great idea, and at their Thanksgiving meal, when the whole family was there, children, grandchildren, nieces and nephews. The Molly, being the woman of the house, the senior member of the family, said, "Folks, you're all gathered here, and we want you to know what our wishes are. By you hearing us share them in this forum, we're letting you know that we're okay. We've made these decisions, and we want to share them with you first so that you know what's coming from our perspective. Second, if there's any questions you don't feel comfortable, we're here to explain it to you while we're able. And three, we expect you to follow our wishes." And I hope that other families will take the lead. If Thanksgiving isn't the time that everyone gathers, pick another time. But having this open discussion is so critical. And yet I realize it's not going to happen in every family. Family dynamics are challenging, and relationships between family members don't always make this easy. But if there isn't the effort to try it, then you're never going to know if you've been able to make your wishes clear to others.
Well, and if you're going to have a big family fight at Thanksgiving dinner like you are every year, it might as well be a useful fight over something worthwhile.
Definitely.
You know, when you write a book, you have a target audience, and I think it's pretty evident with a home hospice navigation that you are writing it for the caregivers, hence the caregiver's guide, the subtitle. But wouldn't this also be very useful for the patient themselves? Even if they're, is that someone that you had as an intention when you were writing the book, aside from caregivers, the actual patients themselves?
That was really my secondary focus. My primary, as you said, is the caregiver themselves, or the person coordinating for all of the caregivers. The loved one hopefully doesn't have to deal with the mechanics of caregiving, or the caregiver that doesn't show up. That shouldn't be where they're focusing their remaining time. It's interesting that the Bureau of Labor and Statistics notes that 23% of adults between 45 and 64 care for an aging adult. That's a whole lot of people. And that's among roughly 40 million unpaid caregivers in the United States.
We can give...
So there is a large market out there that needs support.
Warren Buffett said that the Trump tax cut gave him $29 million, one individual. What could we have done with that money to help caregivers? Let's talk about caregivers, the same group that you were just talking about. Even the ones that get paid, they don't get paid enough money. They work for companies that can't always provide benefits. You have to have serious dedication to be a caregiver. Am I wrong?
You are right.
There are caregivers out there who it's the only job they can get. And, you know, you're in a nursing home and you have, we've had many, many programs on this very topic. So I'm speaking from the words of many of our past guests. You know, some of these folks that are working in these nursing homes, they have 10 patients, 12 patients, 15 patients to a single individual. They're doing the best they can. This whole topic of caregiving in the United States is underfunded. No one in our government seems to care about it. They care about, you know, other things that... I'm getting off too political here, but we could do a lot better, couldn't we? Your thoughts, Judith.
Many of the caregivers are sandwiched. They are taking care of relatives, and often they have children. So they are trying to be everything to everyone else. Many of them don't have, if we're talking about the untrained family members, they don't have the training. They may not have so support of those around them. They're still trying to hold down a job and deal with their other activities and responsibilities. And if you look at those who are the paid caregivers, it stems from who is their employer and how does the employer value the service that their employee renders. Yes, there are requirements, but some employers do a better job in supporting their employees. And yes, often these individuals are stretched thin. If their replacement caregiver on the next shift doesn't show or shows up late, that leaves them in a bind. Can they leave their patient or their loved one? So it's definitely not an easy issue. And caregiving is expensive.
Yes, it is. And let's talk about that. You know what else is expensive? Nursing homes and hospice care facilities. So whether you're doing it in a facility or whether you're doing it in your home, let's talk about the cost differences. I have relatives right now that we're going through the nursing home thing with. And to find a nursing home that you would feel comfortable leaving your loved one in, we're talking $5,000, $6,000, $7,000 a month. A month. Who has that kind of money? Now, is that comparable to someone that goes into hospice care? Meaning a hospice facility, not a home care.
To be in a hospice facility, you are either there for crisis management, meaning your symptoms need to be brought under control. And once they're under control, you would either go back to your nursing home or you'd go back home. The other time folks are in a hospice facility is often at the very end of their journey. Hospice is not, for most, the place you can spend an extended period of time. So that family and caregiving activities will either take place in the home or in a facility. And if they're in a facility paying that $4,000, $5,000, $6,000 or more a month, then the basic caregiving responsibilities fall to the facility and the facility staff.
What is the medical requirement when a doctor, or perhaps more importantly, unfortunately, more importantly, the insurance company, what is the... If someone's getting progressively worse in a nursing home, when do they say, okay, you now qualify for either home or facility hospice care?
There are very strict criteria. Obviously, it is the deterioration in the clinical condition, but there are also certain diagnoses that will help to... get someone into the hospice program. And typically the criteria that Medicare uses are the same criteria that the insurance companies and Medicaid are using. Typically symptoms progress to the point where they cannot be managed or relief obtained. And they may have failure to thrive, which is the frail with a significant weight loss or protein lack of sufficient amount of protein, end-stage AIDS, difficulty with bodily functions and movement, the Parkinson's or the neurological diseases such as the strokes and comas, pain management where pain just cannot be controlled anymore, the dependence on others for what we call the activities of daily living, which are the feeding, bathing, toileting, dressing, and transfers, and then the advanced heart, liver, kidney, and lung disease, difficulty with nausea and vomiting. You see that often with the cancer folks. And the changing or decreased level of consciousness or alertness, and then your various different types of dementias.
We are speaking with Judith Sands. She is the author of the book Home Hospice Navigation, The Caregiver's Guide. And in case someone can't stay with us the whole show, Judith, let's tell them right now, and we'll tell them later as well, where can they get your book?
The easiest place is to go to judithsands.com, my website, and that contains helpful information, resources, and the link to purchase the book.
Of course, we have that link provided at the Artist First homepage for live shows, and after the show, the link will be right next to the archive link. We always want to make it easy for the listeners out there to get in touch with and purchase the books and music you hear on this broadcast. Getting back to it for a minute to the, which I thought that was a great idea, your friend confronting her family at Thanksgiving dinner. But boy, siblings fight, whether they're 9 years old or 59 years old, siblings fight about stuff. In your case, being a only child, you may have been spared that. But any thoughts on refereeing, how to get the siblings all on the same page?
That needs to hopefully start with the loved one who can bring the siblings together or speak to the siblings separately and hopefully make it clear, share with them a written copy of the advance directive, that document which specifies how they would like to be managed and cared for should they not be able to speak for themselves. Now that's the ideal. Often one of those siblings is named as the primary caregiver or the healthcare surrogate, the one legally bound to make those decisions once the loved one cannot. And hopefully, when decision-making needs to take place, it happens. But then this may be the time to bring in clergy or another trusted individual who is respected by both parties that can kind of mediate. But ultimately, it's truly the healthcare surrogate who has that power, the legal power, to make those decisions. But it doesn't mean it's making it pleasant or comfortable. And I've often seen a relative come out of the woodwork as the loved one is declining and the hospice decision is made. And this new relative says, you know, that's not what Mama would have wanted. And when you say, well, when was the last time you spoke to Mama? 5 years ago. When did you see Mama last? 10 years ago. Well, you know, you've missed something along the way. We hear what you're saying. We respect your opinion. But unfortunately, you have not been around, seen, and experienced the challenges of decline.
Well, and unfortunately, in the United States of America, this is not uncommon knowledge, we pay the highest costs for pharmaceutical drugs in the world. We also pay the highest costs for medical care in the world. I would presume then that would also encompass nursing home expenses, among the highest costs to average citizens in the world. So, being that greed is built into our system, people have to think about expenses. Now, I was just doing some little napkin math here. Do you think the average home care or caregiver makes $15 an hour? Is that a reasonable, is that too high?
It may be too high, but there's also a geographic component to that. Certain parts of the country, the same care may cost double what it costs in other parts.
Well, and if you work for a, if that caregiver is not independent, and that caregiver works for a company, remember, that company, on most cases, is paying 28% in taxes over and above what they're paying the employee. Welcome to the
Correct.
Business world. So just on a little napkin math, if you were home hospicing and were able to bring in a caregiver just for 8 hours a day, that is $120 a day. And it's not a five-day-a-week job. The patient needs care 7 days a week. So that's $840 a week, or $43,680 a year, just to have somebody there one-third of the time. So if you needed 24-hour care, it would be closer to $130,000 a year. Wow. That is withering. You know, for those of us who are looking down the road, I'm in my 50s. I have parents in the 80s. That's yikes. Can you work enough hours in this country and put away that much money so that you could, you know? But like you say, if someone's in a hospice situation, they're probably not going to, they're not expected to survive more than, you know, a reasonable amount of time, although many do. Right? I mean, isn't that the case that in some cases where someone is, you know, told, okay, go home and be comfortable and make your peace with God, and a year later, they're still there?
Correct. The criteria for hospice is a life expectancy less than 6 months. Now, patients may thrive a little bit. They may decline, thrive, and it's a roller coaster. There are patients on hospice for a number of years. It's a smaller number, and unfortunately, those are the folks that get to hospice early and get the opportunity to take advantage of the rich hospice benefit. There's another group of about 50% who make it to hospice and spend less than 7 days there.
Wow.
So they don't get, it's not just the patient or the loved one, but their family doesn't get the support for as long a period of time as those that you start with the 6 months and go from there. And it's a recertification by a physician or a nurse practitioner that the loved one still meets the criteria for hospice eligibility.
Well, the two major categories are home or a facility for hospice. Are there others? Am I missing something? Are those the basically the two categories that folks are going to choose from?
Correct. You might be in an assisted living. You might be in a nursing home, your own home, or even an independent living. But independent living is still considered the individual's home.
Now, what would that be like? In other words, a community where they would live in their own home, but it is a private community that's run by healthcare and caregiver folks. Is that correct?
Independent living, there is no medical staff as a routine. Some of these facilities have engaged with home health agencies and allow different caregiving entities to come in, or allow caregivers come in. Not everyone on hospice, especially someone who's in a rallying phase, may need extensive care. They may be able to be left alone for a period of time and not need constant care. So in independent living, they may still go down to the dining room. They may still participate in the bingo or the art activities, but their stamina has been decreasing over time. They may be taking more pain management medications and getting more therapy in terms of eradicating a condition, because that would not be part of the hospice program. But they may be getting a treatment to alleviate discomfort, such as a wound dressing or something like that.
So, of course, the medical condition of the patient is going to determine what possible services are available in that instance. But aside from that, what tips would you give to family members when they're going to try to figure out what's the best choices for them that you were just mentioning?
First, I would suggest that they speak with the loved one's physician, the individual or nurse practitioner who has been caring for that person over time. What is their professional opinion as to the needs? If they have been receiving therapy prior to the decision to go on hospice, well, what kinds of therapies? Was it physical therapy? Well, what does the physical therapist say so that the patient can be kept safe and minimize the risk of falls or trips? Occupational therapists often have great ideas for how to modify the silverware or feeding so that it's less risky to the patient. So speaking to the professionals that have been involved in the care, if the individual is coming out of a hospital, the case manager or the discharge planner often has great insight to future needs and can help direct the family or the caregivers to needed services and available hospice options.
Pain management with hospice is probably a pretty common occurrence. Am I wrong?
Is time management?
Pain management.
Pain management, yes it is. And that's truly a hot topic today, given the unfortunate situation where opioids are abused. When an individual goes into hospice, they are given what's called a comfort pack, which typically is to be kept in the loved one's refrigerator. That comfort pack often includes narcotics, morphine, as well as medications to alleviate nausea and vomiting, constipation, fever. And when there's a lot of caregivers, need to be sure that that packet stays intact. And you have to be able to account for where the medication is going and that it goes to the patient. Unfortunately, I've heard of these comfort packs disappearing or portions of them disappearing. And in today's environment, it's awful because that may mean the patient or the loved one who truly needs the medicine may not have it there when they really need it.
Well, what's the stat I saw recently? Is it 147 a day are dying from opioids or... you know, addiction to heroin or the fentanyl crisis, all stemming from the same opioid problem. But the drug companies are making money, folks. So are the cartels. They're doing real good. On the topic of pain management, I have a relative who's in her 40s, and she has an extremely rare kidney problem where her kidneys produce kidney stones every day. It's very painful for her. And she has been on morphine lollipops for 17 years. Morphine lollipops. They come in this little box. They're about $900 a month, and they look just like small Tootsie Pops, those little dum-dums you used to get at the, you know, at the candy counter. And they're morphine. And to manage her pain, her doctor has had her on these for 17 years. She recently went off of the morphine, and now she takes cannabis. They have legalized pot in the state of Ohio where she lives, and she now gets the same relief for about $30 a month that she was getting from the $900 a box morphine that her body has been being ruined by for the past 17 years. Now, how serious, you know, many states it's legal, 24 states have now legalized it for medicinal uses. What are your thoughts on patients getting relief from an herb rather than a pharmaceutical?
Well, I've got to say that one, Scott, is truly out of my league. Not something that I have researched or ventured into.
I believe it's 24 states now. I mean, we got to think that the people running the governments of those 24 states, those legislatures, they're not dummies. Well, okay, so some of them are, but one would have to think. And again, 17 years of morphine, it's destroying her body. You know, I mean, and yet she can, and folks, you can consume cannabis in brownies. You can eat it. You can make cookies out of it. Yeah, they put it in soda pop, candy bars, gummy bears. You know, you don't want to have a picture of your grandfather sitting there smoking a joint, although if you got relief from it, I'm okay with that. But anyway, yeah, and I don't know how many civilized countries around the world this has been legal for many, many years for medicinal use. But the drug companies can't figure out a way to make money off it. So I don't know. I hope that it becomes legal for medicinal uses in all 50 states. At least give the family an option. Because if you take that away, if you live in a state where that's not an option, what are your choices? I know what I pay for drugs each month as a diabetic. It would knock you down, folks. I can't imagine what it would be like to be in a hospice situation and have to purchase these drugs monthly. Would you have any idea like that comfort pack? If you had to go to a pharmacy and purchase those items in that comfort pack, any idea what that would run you?
The hospice comfort pack comes as part of the hospice benefit. The medications that individuals take while they're in hospice, as long as they are related to the diagnosis that got them into hospice, they are covered. Now, for example, if you go into hospice for cancer diagnosis, but you're also taking a high blood pressure pill, the high blood pressure pill would probably not be covered, but anything related to pain management and the alleviation of the cancer symptoms would, yes, be covered by the hospice benefit.
Well, let's talk about another scary topic in this whole genre, and that's the mental state of the patient themselves. You know, here you are in a lousy situation. You've been given a clock. Someone is, you know, you understand if you're not an Alzheimer's patient and you still have a good mind, you pretty much know that the clock is running down. So what advice would you give people to help keep the spirits up, if that's a simple way to simplify the question? How do you keep somebody's mental focus away from, I can't comprehend what that's like, being faced with your imminent death, and in many cases being in terrible pain, even the benefit of being home and surrounded by loved ones. What do we do about their psychological state of mind?
Often their personality and their traits prior to going on hospice are going to perk up and percolate. So those that adapt well over time will have a different outlook than those that have viewed the cup as empty or half empty. There are those that become very depressed, and often it's related to unfulfilled, unaddressed, open issues in their lives, or realizing that they cannot change anything at this point in their lives. And there are others that still say, you know, I'm here another day. I have my loved ones around me. How wonderful. They may both groups may benefit from clergy, from being with friends, and participating to the best of their abilities in some kind of an enjoyable activity or an activity that has brought meaning to them over the years, whether it's bingo, sketching, writing, singing, or for others, it may just be listening to some music and being alone. But social workers within hospice are available to assist these individuals and help draw them out or help them bring closure onto issues that are of concern to them.
Well, it's a difficult topic we're talking about tonight with Judith Sands, our guest, and her book is entitled Home Hospice Navigation, The Caregiver's Guide. I think, as I mentioned earlier in the broadcast, very timely book, as so many baby boomers are aging, and this topic is going to come up a lot more frequently now than probably any other time in our nation's history. Let's remind everybody again, in case they missed the first half of the show, where can they pick up your book?
The easiest place is going to judithsands.com, my website, where they will see information on ordering the book and resources to assist them during this journey.
Well, a little bit more on the psychology of dying, which, yikes, we'll all face that sooner or later. I suppose it makes a big difference if that person was, let's say, religious. Not, I don't care what religion, but if that was something they thought about through their lifetime, whatever faith they had, they would have some expectation of what might happen after they die. I've had the pleasure of interviewing Danion Brinkley. I don't know if that name rings any bells to you, Judith, but he was one of the first folks that came out in a scientific way, in a public way, to talk about the near-death experience. Last time I interviewed him, he had had four of them. I like to call them I died for a while experiences. It changed his life. And at the time I interviewed him, he had held in his arms 400 people at the instant of their death. And since then, he was just back on our station a couple months ago. That number's now over 5,000. There are folks out there who claim now, using the scientific method, to have some insight to what happens after you die. I wonder if any of that information could be useful and helpful to people in the hospice situation. What do you think?
Great question. I think it depends on the individual's level of alertness and awareness. I am not familiar with his work. We're a little more familiar with Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, denial, anger, bargaining, guilt, and acceptance. And it's a little more conventional. And individuals may be able to go through all five phases, or they may get stuck along the way. That's probably something for a little more investigation on my part.
I interviewed a lady that name's Nancy Clark. She's a retired, maybe she's not retired. She works at Ohio State University as a research scientist and has taken up an interest in this when she had her own near-death experience back in the 60s. And there are groups all across the United States of academics, not crazy people with foil hats on, real academics looking at quantifiable evidence that something lives on after the moment of death. I think as science moves forward and answers some of these age-old questions, there might be some comfort there. Some people that aren't religious, you know, it doesn't seem to be a phenomenon that has anything to do with your religion. And of course, if you are of the Hindu faith, you're going, duh, we've known this for thousands of years, but us Westerners over here, we take it a little differently. Well, we have about 4 minutes left in the broadcast. Judith, is there anything, what have we missed? Is there any topic or issues that you want to make sure we get in on this show?
I want to be sure that caregivers really focus on honoring the loved one's advance directive. It may seem obvious, but they have a responsibility. And it may not always be easy to honor that advance directive. Hopefully the loved one is still able to communicate, and I'd hate to say negotiate because there should not be negotiation there. But if you are taking on the role, you have been appointed as a healthcare surrogate, you truly do have an obligation to follow that advance directive. And there's another point that I would like to have the audience remember. that there's sometimes that our medical professionals, our doctors, our nurse practitioners, our physician assistants may forget to offer or suggest the hospice option. And there is absolutely no reason why the patient, the loved one, the family can't say, "Doc, do you think this is the time where we could, should explore hospice?" And in fact, families can call hospice and ask for a free evaluation so they know for themselves if they weren't happy with the practitioner's response. Additionally, I think caregivers need to know that they may be the project manager or the care coordinator for the loved one, and they need to be supported. And often they may just be too tired to ask for help, too tired to say to someone, "You know what, mow my lawn today. Please pick up the gallon of milk for me." But we, as members of society and friends of caregivers, need to be better friends and better supporters and say to those going through the caregiving journey, "I will pick up your mail today. I will get your car filled with gas." Whatever that specific measurable activity or task is to make the caregiver's journey a little bit simpler.
Well said. In the recent tax bill that was just passed by the Republican-controlled Congress, we went into debt trillions of dollars. Trillions of dollars we added to the national debt. And I don't think there was any money in there to help caregivers in this country. Shameful. Most of the tax benefits went to less than 1% of the taxpayers, the richest people in the country, the ones that didn't need it. Why don't we create a branch of government, a national caregivers cabinet level group, organization, where we take tax dollars and put it into a fund that helps create better pay, regulations, and benefits for people that are caregivers. Now, is that just a crazy left-wing idea? Am I a socialist, Judas?
Wow, that's a loaded one. There's definitely need on the national level to address the whole issue of caregiving. It's a growing problem. There aren't going to be enough caregivers, and those that are going to be the caregivers need to be supported in any way possible, not just with training, but being able to provide the care safely and being viewed as professionals, because to the loved one, to the individual receiving their care, they are their lifeline. And finding the right caregiver for a loved one is a dating process. Not every caregiver is suited for every loved one.
And just like the regular population, there's good ones and there's bad ones, right? Well, we are out of time. I'm sorry.
Please. Good and bad, it's personalities as well.
Well, there's the old saying, it's from the Bible, idiots begat idiots. You can look it up, folks. So you're going to run across wonderful people in this world. I wish there were more like our guest tonight, folks. Judith Sands has been our guest. And you guys, if you're in this situation, what a wonderful resource her book entitled Home Hospice Navigation, The Caregiver's Guide. Visit Judith's webpage. It's hername.com, linked up on the Artist First website. And for those of you listening live to this broadcast, a little bit of a segue here. The program that comes on after this is called The Soul of the Everyman. It's a couple, Michael and Margaret Lines, who lost their child to leukemia at the age of 9. And of course, the segue is he required hospice care as well. They are some truly wise people, and they always have some very critical wisdom to impart on you listeners, and that will be following this broadcast. Judith, thank you so much. I know this is your first book. If you have another book or another project that we can help you get some publicity out for, we'd love to have you back on. You're a wonderful guest, and our station is at your disposal.
Thank you so much, and I really appreciate the opportunity to spread the word about home hospice navigation.
Well, come back when you have more information for our listeners. And folks, get out there, get a copy of the book. Oh, I didn't ask you, is your book available as an e-book or an audiobook?
It is available as an e-book and a soft copy, soft cover copy.
Well, there you go, folks. This will conclude this broadcast of Authors First on the Artists First Radio Network. Tony Kay expects to be back here next week. He had a little medical emergency, and I'm grateful he allowed me to fill his shoes tonight. Judith, give a hug to the husband, and we'll see you soon.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.